Last week, I introduced this series of sermons. I said I was going to speak about the life of King David. And last week we talked about his family background. We saw from the book of Ruth that his family history could be traced back to a man named Perez. Perez and his twin brother Zerah were born to Judah, one of the 12 sons of Jacob. And when we looked at the circumstances surrounding the arrival of Perez in the world, we saw that it was not the nicest of tales. Perez was born in sad circumstances, with nobody involved showing particularly honourable conduct. But we also saw that in God's grace, a family which had started badly proved to be a family of honour and blessing in the country of Israel. Judah's line was identified as the tribe of the future king, and Perez himself was to have a family that became well known in the land as having been blessed by God. Well, having introduced David through his ancestors last week, I want to now move forward in time to David's own point in history. We aren't told much about David's younger childhood, although we do have pieces of information here and there. The Bible mostly concentrates on David's adult life, with just brief glimpses back into his youngest years. And as we work through the series in the coming weeks, we'll hear about some of them. So what I want to do instead this morning is talk about the situation in the country when David was growing up. I want to talk about what was the atmosphere in Israel. What were the influences that were affecting David in his childhood? What example did he have that would influence him later on in the role that he would play in Israel? And I want to talk about the more general influences, not just the personal ones within his own family. Now, I suppose we could do that by me trying to provide a sort of survey of Israel in the time of David, but I don't think I'd be able to do it. So instead, what I want us to do instead is listen to one man's voice. And that's why we read earlier from 1 Samuel and chapter 12. Here in chapter 12 we have Samuel, the leader of Israel when David was growing up, or at least the initial leader. And in chapter 12 we have Samuel's state of the country address. And by listening to Samuel, hopefully that will at least tell us something about what was going on as David grew up in the country of Israel, as David grew up in Bethlehem. Samuel has been a public figure since his childhood. I'm sure most of you remember the story of how Samuel came to be the leader of Israel. But now he's an old man, and his time is running out. And certainly his time as leader is over, because, as he says, a king has now been appointed in the country, and that's King Saul. And so Samuel stands up at the end of his time as leader of Israel to make this speech to the nation. This is his summing up of where he believes things are now up to. Now I want to look at the themes of his speech through one particular question. And the question is this: what was Samuel's example of leadership? What sort of leader was Samuel? What comes out as he looks back at his legacy? And I think there are three things to note here. Three things that we can see about Samuel's leadership of Israel that would have been an example to David in his young days. The first thing I want you to see is that Samuel was a leader who had integrity. He opens his speech by calling upon anybody present to identify any bribery or any corruption that's occurred during his premiership. Samuel has been the judge of Israel. He's had to make choices which have decided legal cases. He's had to make choices that have affected people's lives. Now, anybody in that situation can fall prey to bribery. A backhander, a brown envelope of £50 notes, a promise of a favour to be repaid, an opportunity to gain promotion or loyalty in the eyes of others. The temptations of authority are great, and we often see people exploiting them. Human beings find it very hard to rise into jobs of importance and power without using them for personal gain of one sort or another. But Samuel insists that he has stood against that. In his own young days, when Samuel was based at the temple, he would have seen Hophni and Phinehas. They were two men who were the sons of the last great priest, Eli. Eli was the man, you remember, who trained Samuel. Both of those men, Hophni and Phinehas, were corrupt. They exploited their positions for their own benefits. They used their place as leaders to gain material benefits from people. And they used their power as leaders to gain sexual favours. They were without integrity in their attitudes or conduct. And God put them to death on a Philistine battlefield. Samuel remembered those men, and he didn't want to be like them. Sadly, Samuel's own sons didn't turn out as well as their father. As Samuel's sons matured into fellow leaders alongside Samuel, they were prepared to accept bribes. They were prepared to twist or pervert justice. The temptations that come upon someone who has power, who has authority, are great. But Samuel didn't give in to them. He lived a life which upheld high standards. And now he could stand before all Israel at the end of his long life, as he says, stand before them old and grey, and he could call openly for anyone to question his integrity. He said to them, have I exploited my leadership for personal gain? Can anybody here say that I've taken their ox or their donkey? Had he used his power to deceive anyone for his own benefit? Was he guilty of fraud? Had he used his ruling authority to silence people, to shut people up who got in the way of his plans? Did he operate a secret police? Was he guilty of oppression? Had he been open, he says, can anybody say that I've accepted bribes? Was I open to bribery to make sure that legal decisions went the right way? Samuel opens himself up and he calls upon anyone with a charge against him, to bring it out in the open now so that everyone can hear it. And he promises that if anything has happened, he will make good that wrong. He will pay back anything that's been wrongly taken. And everybody stays quiet. No one brings a single accusation. Samuel hasn't gone down any of these paths. And in fact, they then give a shout. They all proclaim that there's no charges to be brought. But that isn't enough for Samuel. He's not just looking for sort of end-of-term flattery. Oh, you've been a wonderful leader without fault. Now out of the way and let's have the king. He's looking for it to be established definitely that he has not been corrupt. And so he says to the Israelites, you must vow in the presence of two witnesses that I've taken nothing from you, that I've not cheated any of you. His two witnesses are firstly God himself, and secondly God's own representative, the anointed king. He says to the Israelites, will you vow in the presence of these two witnesses And the Israelites say, we do. God is our witness. Samuel had been a leader who had integrity. Secondly, he was also a leader who was devoted to his responsibilities. At the end of his speech, in verse 23, he says this. As for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by failing to pray for you, and I will teach you the way that is good and right. Samuel is making this speech because he's handing over responsibilities. He's handing them over as leader in Israel to the new king. And he's not doing that in the happiest of circumstances. Earlier on in chapter 8, when the people first asked for a king, Samuel was upset by them, by their attitudes. He felt that what was happening was that he was being rejected in favour of having a king. And the whole process, therefore, has not been a positive one for Samuel. You could understand him taking his leave now. You could imagine another man saying, well, if they don't want me, that's fine, but let them see how they get on with this new wonder king of theirs. And yet Samuel doesn't react in that way. He doesn't say that. He feels a duty towards these people before God. Their actions against him, the upset they've caused him, the offence, the rejection, aren't sufficient reason for him to write them off out of personal pique, out of offence. He's not prepared to indulge in sour grapes. Samuel tells the people that he will continue to care for them. Despite all they've done, through all the pain of leading these people, despite the way they've treated him, still he is devoted to his responsibilities to them. The things he's been given by God to do for these people. And still he wants their good. And so he tells them that he's going to remain consistent. Those key things which he's done for them in the past, he's going to carry on doing them in the future. His work carries on, even though officially he's retiring from the post. So Samuel was a leader with integrity, but he was also one with a devotion to the responsibilities. He didn't just do them whilst he had them and that was it. He was cut off cold from them. He had a devotion to the work God had given him. And then thirdly, which I'm sure is linked with that, he was a leader who walked closely with God. That comes out throughout his speech, doesn't it? His great concern is to bring these people back to God. He preaches God to them over and again. He wants them to think about what God has done. He wants them to remember God's actions in the past. And he wants them to remember God's reactions in the past as well. He tells them of their duty to God. He warns them against turning away from God's ways to their own ways. He preaches to them their sins before God. And then he gives a public demonstration. The people see this man's trust in God in action. He tells them that God is now going to make plain the truth of what he's speaking to them. In verse 18 it says this. Then Samuel called upon the Lord, and that same day the Lord sent thunder and rain. So all the people stood in awe of the Lord and Samuel. The people all said to Samuel, pray to the Lord your God for your servants, so that we will not die, for we have added to all our other sins the evil of asking for a king. Samuel prayed that a terrifying thunderstorm would appear at a time in the year when they were never expected. This was the wheat harvest. It was in May and June. It was the wrong time in the calendar for a rainstorm like this. But God made it come specially in answer to the prayers of this man Samuel. God honours Samuel. He affirms the things he's saying to Israel. In particular, he affirms Samuel's assessment of Israel's wrong action in demanding a king. An assessment which Samuel himself received prophetically from God. Samuel is a man who is walking closely with God. He hears words from God, he offers prayers to God, and those prayers are heard, and those prayers are answered. And then, of course, in verse 23, which we read just now, Samuel himself says, and those two things are key to what I've been doing. I'm going to carry on praying. I'm going to carry on teaching you what's right and what's good. He tells the people that he'll carry on praying for them. They've seen what Samuel's prayers can do. And in fact, they've pleaded with him to keep on praying. Samuel's prayers are powerful. He is a man who is walking closely with God. And Samuel promises them that his prayers will be for them, not against them. And he tells them that he will teach them what is good and right. That will carry on. In his leadership, Samuel walked closely with God. It goes to the heart of what this man is about. Samuel's relationship with God defined the way in which he led Israel. He sees those things as the key elements of his work. They are the things he feels he must carry on. He can't stop doing whatever else he's retiring from. Samuel is a man of God. His closeness to God runs through all he is, and it shapes and forms all that he does. So there are those three things to note about Samuel's leadership of Israel. He was a man, he was a leader with integrity. He was a man, a leader with devotion. He was a man, a leader of godliness. And that is the example which David saw. As David was growing up in the land, people will have talked about Samuel. They'll have talked about the way he's leading the country. Just as we do today. They didn't have the BBC. They didn't have the 6 o'clock news or the Today programme. There was no Daily Mirror, no Daily Mail, no The Times to tell the news and to give opinion. But people were still the same as we are. News, gossip, stories will have passed around the country about this and about that, about what's going on in the great towns and cities of the land, what's going on in the political centres. And then when Samuel went out and travelled across the country, when he went to sort out problems, when he went to hear the legal cases, the people will have met his entourage, they'll have heard from them about what Samuel's doing, about how Samuel's behaving. All leaders leave behind them a legacy. All leaders leave behind them an impression of what they were and what they did for the country. If you think of Mr. Blair or Mr. Major or Mrs. Thatcher or Mr. Callaghan or Mr. Wilson or so on, what do you remember? What summarises their leadership? Well, as Samuel steps down from the public stage of Israel, steps down from the limelight, these are the things he wants the people to remember. This is the legacy that Samuel was leaving behind to future leaders. Integrity, devotion, godliness. Many of them would ignore it. Samuel knew they would. He warned the people what kings would actually be like. And Saul, the first king, was a letdown. But some would be different. And David, who grew up when Samuel was still the man across the country, David would be different. Samuel's example would be something that David himself would live by in many ways. He would fall. He would not be consistent as a king. But all these three characteristics would influence him, and especially the third one. David would be a man who, as leader, would walk closely with God. Now, of course, as David saw events in the land, there was something else he had to see too. He saw that even though a leader might uphold high standards, that doesn't necessarily make his people loyal. Samuel experienced many things, and that included the fickleness of people. One moment, they're ready to swear their undying loyalty, and the next, they can't look him in the eye because their interest has turned somewhere else, and their opinion of him has collapsed. Samuel knew that from those days when suddenly the people were demanding a king. In chapter 8, we're told how the people became restless. Because Samuel's sons weren't proving to be as great as the father before them, because they were just a shadow of their father, the people looked outwards. They began to envy other nations, because other nations had kings, and they didn't. Samuel hadn't set up a national dynasty, a line of kings to rule, but they wanted one. Samuel had encouraged the status quo, with judges like himself doing the work of leading the land. But the people didn't want it. They wanted a king like other countries. Only a king was good enough. Samuel told the people off for that in his speech. He tells them off for it in the speech we've read. He warns them that their attitude is a rejection not just of him, but it's also a rejection of God. That God himself should have been trusted as the king of the people. But that wasn't good enough for them. They wanted a real life, a flesh and blood, a crown on his head king. They wanted someone they could see, someone they could watch striding out to protect them. And so it was that despite Samuel's great example, despite his godliness, despite his prayerfulness and the power of his prayers, despite Samuel's leadership of Israel and his teaching of what is right and good, still the people didn't trust him and didn't trust God. They needed to be like everyone else. Samuel experienced it. David saw it. And experienced it himself, that people vary in their trust of leaders. Sometimes that's because of evidence about the failings of a leader, and sometimes it's despite it. Our own political leader, Tony Blair, must be pondering that this week. He has a major national inquiry. It's led by a leading judge. It exonerates him from any misconduct whatsoever, and it condemns the BBC who accused him. And yet, if you talk to people, most people still assume that he's done something wrong. Now, my point is not whether he has or hasn't, but simply to point out that that is the attitude leaders face. Samuel knew it. No matter what his standards, what his example was, still the people didn't trust him. They turned away from him. when they saw something that they thought was better. So as David was growing up, these were the things that he saw at work in the land. He saw an example of godly leadership, and he saw that even the finest of leaders doesn't produce the expected reaction from those to whom he's been given. And we'll see those things worked out in the life of David in coming weeks. But for us, as believers here this morning, ultimately we see these things worked out in the life of the finest leader, don't we? In the life of the Saviour himself. In the life of the greatest king the world has seen, Jesus Christ. You watch the Lord Jesus living his life, and it's perfect integrity. He never compromises over anything. There's never a shadow. There's never a question that can be raised about his motives or his actions. At his public trial, his accusers have to resort to lies in order to get the judgment and the death penalty that they desperately wanted. And then you have his devotion, and you see that it's unceasing. The crowds pursue him relentlessly, and he still has compassion on them. His disciples let him down dreadfully, and they were forever misunderstanding what he was saying. And yet he continued to love them, and he continued to teach them. He was an example of perfect integrity, and he was an example of perfect devotion. And above all, within the Saviour, we know that we see perfect godliness. He was a man who walked with God at all times, in all places. His Father was the constant theme of his conversation. His prayers to his Father were unceasing, whether private or public. In his darkest hours, when even God had left him, there on the cross, still he was going back to God and saying, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" It was to God to whom he turned when he had no other explanations, no other answers. When he agonized in painful darkness, still to God he went. Because his heart was utterly bound up in the Father whom he loved. Perfect godliness. What we see in Samuel in part, what David saw, what David lived out himself. For us, all of those elements reach their highest and their best, their finest example in our Saviour. And of course, he knew that people were fickle. One minute, he had people crowding round him to listen to his words, and they wanted to reach out to touch the great man. And the next minute, they're calling for his death, and they're cracking jokes about him as he's nailed up onto a cross. What we see in Samuel, what David saw in Samuel, we see much more fully in Jesus Christ. So that leads us with this question. How should we use this example? I want to suggest two ways in which it applies to us this morning. First of all, surely looking at an example like this gives us something to pray. Something to pray for Christian leaders. Isn't it a delight to see an older leader like this man Samuel, leaving the world having reached and maintained such a standard? You know, the world, it likes to raise people up as leaders, find their failings, and then knock them down again. Or if it can't knock them down whilst they're still leader, then put the knife in after they've gone. That's been there in the Hutton Inquiry, hasn't it? It's part of the fun of life to see politicians falling. It's what fills newspapers, speculating on who's going down next and who's coming up to replace them. But that's not our attitude as Christians, is it? We want leaders in the Christian church who are like Samuel, reaching the end as a godly man with integrity and devotion, not just a faded star who receives our mockery or our pity. Well, if that's what we want, then that's what we need to pray for. You personally know a number of Christian leaders, some better than others. You know some because they have responsibility in this church. You know some because they have responsibility in other churches that you've been a part of or you've visited. You know some because you read about them in the bulletin or in Christian magazines, or you hear about them in the prayer meetings. There are some you know because you've been to conferences to hear them speak, or you've read their books, or you've heard their tapes. You and I need to pray for these men, that they would be helped to reach and maintain God's standards, that they would be helped to resist the temptations they face. Think about yourself. How hard do you find it to maintain integrity? Isn't it true that sometimes it's just easier not to try? It's easier to pull the wool over someone's eyes for our benefit. It's easier to tell a little lie just to smooth things out. It's easier in some situations just to exploit it for our gain. Sometimes we like to play one person off against another so that everything works out for our favour. Or to take something from somebody knowing that we're never going to return it and we're never going to return the favour either. Sometimes we're tempted to ignore a law which nobody will notice that we're breaking. There are times when our integrity breaks, or at least we're tempted to break it. In our lives, with our families, with our friends, in our work, wherever. And basically what it comes down to is this. There's a willingness within us to do what's necessary to get something we want. Samuel asked whether anybody could come forward and show that that's what he was like. To show that he'd used others to gain possessions, to gain money, to cheat them, to double deal, to give in to bribes. When there are things we want, it's hard not to take the easiest route, to get them whatever way comes quickest rather than the right way. Well, if you can see that in yourself, then it will be true of Christian leaders. They face the same temptations. Maybe they're given greater opportunities. And so we need to pray for them that they will pursue what is right and resist what is wrong. How hard do you find it to maintain devotion to your duty? In the Christian life, we can have bouts of enthusiasm, can't we? But they're soon knocked back by difficulties. We're put off. For example, think about some of the duties found in the Bible that we've included in this church's covenant of membership. It's just hard to keep up with them, isn't it? How easy do you find it to use your gifts to the full in the service of the church? And when you do, can you say that it's never without proudly seeking prominence or personal esteem? How easy do you find it to meet together often to remember our Lord's death? How easy do you find it to be constant and regular in attendance at the meetings? Think about a particular promise that we make in the covenant of membership in this church, to freely forgive one another in the Lord. Now that's okay the first time somebody does something which upsets us. We can put it away and we cannot hold it against them until they do it again and again and again. And then bitterness can set in. Samuel was tempted by that. You know, these Israelite people for years had been weakly fluctuating from one lifestyle to another. Samuel points it all out to them between verses 6 and 15. The Lord did great things for them, yet they moaned and they rebelled. Then other nations came against them and oppressed them, so they cried back out to God. They were so sorry, couldn't he now rescue them? And he did. In his mercy, he raised up deliverers to save them from the hands of their enemies. And yet still these people couldn't commit themselves to God. In the end, they simply became convinced they needed a king like other nations. Although the lesson they should have learned was their need of God, they in fact felt a very human need and asked for a king. These people were so feeble, they were forever changing their attitude every few years. They were forever running back to old ways every time circumstances changed. They were totally unpredictable with regard to the future, totally untrustworthy, and Samuel could have just written them off. He could have said, "That's enough. They've caused me enough difficulty and pain." And yet he doesn't. Despite it all, he remains faithful. We too are called to forgive others. Not to bear grudges. Not to become bitter. But how hard it can be. If we find it hard, then we must pray for Christian leaders who, because of their duties, may face great provocation as Samuel did. Pray that they would remain devoted to their duties, not give them up. And then let me ask you, how hard do you find it to maintain godliness? How easy is it to feel a delight and a joy in God, to keep him constantly at the centre of your life? How easy is it to be prayerful, to be turning constantly to God and speaking with him? How easy is it to live by his word, to do the things which he said rather than the things that you feel like doing? How easy is it to keep close to God, to make sure that you have a heart for God? Samuel preached the Lord to the Israelites. It was the Lord who was the centre of his thinking, of his heart, of his speaking, here at the end of his career. He hasn't lost that first passion. Well, if you know that you find it hard to maintain that passion in your life, then you know that Christian leaders find it hard too. Despite the fact that they're up the front preaching, or they're running a meeting, or they're in their study writing a book, or they're at a conference giving a paper, or they're on a mission field preaching to the lost, they find it as hard as you do. And we need to pray for them. So the example of Samuel must cause us to pray for those whom God has given positions of leadership to in the Christian church. But then, secondly, we must also seek to answer our own prayers. What will help them to maintain their standards? What will help them to resist the temptations? The way in which we live. Samuel's greatest problem was the people that God had asked him to lead. Now, Samuel had a far more difficult situation than most Christian leaders. Samuel had to lead a mixed nation of believers and unbelievers. Whilst he was worshipping God, he was only too well aware that other people in the country were all ready to go back to their idols at a moment's notice. The values that Samuel had weren't shared by the country he led. So his situation was different. But the lesson remains the same, doesn't it? That what the people are will either help or hinder what the leader himself is. If we take attitudes that discourage integrity, then those who lead will find it harder to maintain consistency. If we live lives without devotion, then those who lead will find it harder to resist the temptation to tone their own lives down. If we don't seek to walk closely with God, then we'll give our leaders no encouragement to maintain their own walk, to keep their own hearts close to God. So let's not just pray for them, but let's seek in whatever ways we can to answer our own prayers by helping those who lead. And finally, let me say this. We know that in the end, the men who are given earthly responsibility are only sinful men, and they will fail. And so whatever we've talked about this morning, we always come back to this, that our great assurance, our great hope, our trust is built only on the one true leader, the one and only King, Jesus Christ. Whatever we're seeing in those God has placed over the leadership of the church, we always look beyond any human leader to our divine leader, to the Son of God. That is where we as Christians place all our trust. It's where we build all our hope. Yes, Christ has given us leaders in the church to see us through the pilgrimage of life in this fallen world. But they only have any role in as far as Christ has given it to them. And we are to look to Him alone as our only hope, as the only one who can lead us to heaven. And we know this, that He cannot fail us in that.